Welcome, everybody, to another edition of the Inside Indy Sports Podcast. I'm Tyler James, and I'm joined once again by the one and only Eric Hansen. Together, we cover Notre Dame football, recruiting, and more for InsideIndySports.com on the Rivals Network. Notre Dame wobbled its way to a 28-3 victory over Miami of Ohio last weekend to set up a ranked matchup with Louisville in Notre Dame Stadium on Saturday. Not only do the Irish need a win to keep their college ball playoff hopes alive, but they can do so against the same team that extinguished those hopes last season. To help us set expectations for Saturday's game, we reached out to former Notre Dame offensive lineman and the younger half of the Gojo and Golic show on the DraftKings Network, Mike Golic Jr. Mike, thanks for joining us.
Appreciate you guys having me. And yeah, the younger version of that, I'll go with that one. Usually people go the hair route, so I appreciate you guys catering to your current audience.
Mike, can you walk us through your emotions as a Notre Dame football fan the past 4 weeks?
Oh, it's been hellish. I mean, you know what? It's something that I'm very intimately familiar with, both as a fan growing up and a player that was a part of teams that had similar, you know, misfortune against opponents that we were supposed to beat. And so I went through the roller coaster of emotions that I've been used to my whole life, but I've been encouraged by the response from these guys. Obviously, the week after you suffer that going on the road and doing so. Wasn't going to calm everything down, but it at least takes that immediate sting off of it and allows you to sort of exhale and realize, okay, the sky is not totally falling. It might have cracked. There is maybe a little bit of peace coming through, but you've got a lot to play for and still plenty of bright spots, I think, on this team to focus on.
The interesting thing for me, Mike, is it feels like weekly now since the Northern Illinois lost. The questions I get are always these huge picture questions. Yeah. Is Marcus the guy? Is Ryan Leonard the guy? Is the offensive line ever going to get better? So let's start with the Marcus question. What are you seeing from him in year three that you like? What are you seeing that you say, okay, if he's going to have a statue someday, this is where I feel like improvement needs to be made?
Well, I mean, I think it is that consistency in how you approach a game like we saw against Northern Illinois, where coming off that one, hearing Marcus's explanations and talking about the team losing focus and stuff like that, like, those are the things that fall under the purview and the guidance of the head coach. And so you've got to wear that. It's what Brian Kelly had largely gotten out of the program by the time that he left in those latter 5 years, where, yeah, you could talk about Notre Dame having a big game problem, but man, you weren't going to lose the ones that you weren't supposed to. And so I think that's still the area, you know, that was going to follow Marcus coming off the first year where he was the full-time coach, where, hey, losing to Ohio State's one thing, but then losing to Marshall's a completely different conversation. Stanford, all that stuff that comes up. And so I think that's still an area that comes with time. I mean, I have to constantly remind myself, this is now him starting year three on the job of being a head coach. And while you see so many ways that he's so much more comfortable in the seat and has a deeper understanding of what the job entails, has the assistants now that he can fully delegate to, not just on the defensive side of the ball, but also, you know, offensively, and Mike Denbrock, who's a guy that's been around so long and has all those years of experience, that we're still early. What year threes are built to be around Notre Dame and around a lot of programs in college football when you take over.
Just following up on that, I mean, BK had been a head coach for a long time when he came to Notre Dame, but you had him in year one, two, and three of his regime. Be honest now, whether it was at the time or in the rearview mirror, did you ever look back in his early years and go, what is he thinking?
You know what? It was interesting because, like, you could tell there were spots where Brian was getting used to making the jump to that level of football, right? To big time power, then power five, now power four football from all the spots along the way. You saw the early signs of a coach that had been around winning for a long time and who had already been in the head coaching chair. And I do think that's of note with Brian is he had been a head coach at, you know, Grand Valley, at Cincinnati, at Central Michigan. And so he came in and knew immediately where he wanted things. He didn't have to go through that process we saw Marcus talk about publicly at the beginning, where you go and you ask your old coaches, guys that you had been head coaches under, how they do certain things. Brian knew how he wanted things done in terms of the day-to-day organization. It was just dealing with, hey, how different recruiting is at this level, managing the game situations at this level, and some of the environments you're going to encounter. And so I think, no, there was never really a moment where it's like, damn, what the hell's really going on here, as much as it is, the growing pains that you're going to go through with any new staff in the country that's going to any new program in the country. And a lot of those things are really unavoidable. And so for Marcus, it's the same but different in that, you know, he's being a head coach for the first time. And so some of those things that, you know, Charlie Weiss, who had come over before, who I got at the end of his time at Notre Dame. But when he first got there, that was his first time being a head coach in college football, coming from the NFL. And so I'm sure in a similar way, while he had been around Bill Belichick and been around the Patriots, there were probably things that he learned on the job as well. And so I think they're kind of very different things to compare in terms of, yeah, being a head coach at Notre Dame for the first time, but being a head coach period for the first time and all the newness that comes with that.
Mike, Eric mentioned Notre Dame's offensive line earlier, and that's a unit that started the season with three first-time starters. The two guys that had some starting experience have gotten hurt since then. How would you evaluate the play of the offensive line thus far?
Better than it has any right to be, considering everything you just mentioned. I mean, dear God, you lost the dude you expected to be your starting left tackle before the season even got going. And then you lost two guys off the interior. And thankfully, the guys coming up behind them, you know, Rocco had played football already. Pat had played football already in an Irish uniform in meaningful games. And that stuff showed up and mattered. And so I think, yeah, for Joe Rudolph's a guy I don't know personally. I've seen his work from afar. I've been really impressed because you see them all putting consistent things on tape. And to me, that's the sign of good coaching when you can see it across a unit. And I think, you know, you've seen improvement from Anthony Knapp on the left side from game one, where he's baptized by fire down in College Station against some of the best rushers and most talented players in college football, to now going in this last game where, hey, listen, we said it at the start of the season, having a quarterback that's a massive plus in the run game only helps that unit up front. Having a running back as talented as Jeremiah, having Jadarian behind him who's all, you know, close to as talented, and Anais and all these guys, the depth in that room, it all helped the line. But that being said, I think they're playing pretty solid football, again, for a group that's been jumbled as much as they have through the first 4 weeks of the season. You saw some consistency in this last game. You saw some things that they were comfortable with. I mean, God, over and over with that, like, outside, you know, mid zone Y insert play that they ran the entire day with the tight ends to some pretty good effect. I thought you've seen a lot of consistency out of this group. I've really liked Emil Agner and what he's put together at right tackle. He's been super consistent for them. Sam Pendleton, coming in as young as he is, really like the future for him. Very powerful guy, can really dig guys out of there. I think that interior has been a solid strength for them, even as they've turned over after some of the injuries. And I don't know, that's a group I said a couple of weeks ago after I went back and watched the Northern Illinois tape, like, that group played well enough to win that game in my mind. And so I think that's been the case for them now, and they're only getting more confident with reps.
Mike, it feels like this is an inflection point for Riley Leonard, for the offensive line, for Mike Denbrock, all the things that went against Louisville or in the Louisville game last year. You have a chance to remedy those. You have a running quarterback where you didn't have it last year. You had a better offensive line last year. I mean, you had two really good tackles, but, and you have a more experienced offensive coordinator. So what's your sense of how that's going to play out? Louisville's ability to stuff Notre Dame's run last year and force turnovers and get sacks versus what Notre Dame is putting on the field offensively this year.
Yeah, I think for Notre Dame this year offensively, way more spread out scheme, right? For the last few years, it had been so tight end centric, the stuff that you're used to around Notre Dame. And it's not to say the tight end room's still not getting a bunch of use. We've seen Eli and Cooper and Mitch all out there getting plenty of time, but a lot more spread out formations, quarterback on maybe one of those guys on the field at the time with some 12 mixed in. So I think that helps already, because at their best, Louisville wants to cause chaos around the line of scrimmage. And that's a lot easier to do when you've got larger personnel groups on the field all at once. And so by spreading it out, by having the quarterback be as viable a run threat, and I think seeing Riley get more comfortable passing the ball this last week, you saw more balls cut loose in tighter windows, more balls thrown over the middle of the field. We know We finally got the monkey off his back of the first touchdown pass in a Notre Dame uniform thrown. And I don't think it's any accident it came in a two-minute drill. I always think whether it's a young quarterback or a quarterback who's trying to build confidence in that area the way Riley was to start this season, getting out of your head and into a minute, two-minute drill where you're running familiar concepts, you got to get up and go. You're so focused on the machinations of that area of the game in particular that you stop trying to place the ball and you just throw the damn thing the way we all knew he's capable of. We've seen him do it. And so I think all that will help you try and take the teeth out of a group up front that plays with their hair on fire, wants to get upfield, wants to wreak havoc, and making a D-line have to think because of all the things that you can present there around the line of scrimmage led by your quarterback, I think goes a long way in giving them a chance to remedy that.
Mike, are there guys on Notre Dame's offense that you would like to see get more touches?
I mean, I thought in the receiver room, I know we all came into the season with some preconceived notions. Like, obviously, Jordan gets banged up early on here. We heard about Jaden Greathouse all through camp. But, like, I like seeing what Bo Collins has put on tape. Big. I remember meeting him over the summer. Kid's huge.
Yeah.
And so right away, I'm like, we haven't had a lot of guys with his physical profile around here. So that's exciting. And is he the fastest guy in the world? No, but he's savvy. He's got good body control. He presents a big target to Riley, which I think as your quarterback's trying to get going and get some confidence, having a guy with a big set of numbers and mitts that you can put that on goes a long way. And so I'm just kind of excited to see how Denbrock keeps finding a way to feature him. We saw him as kind of a screen guy early on. He catches the go ball on the 2-minute drill this week. And so I think for them, and then, just trying to see how they mix in the rest of that room. But no, like the running back room, God, Jeremiah is a special player.
Yeah.
Like as many play, and we've seen, they've tried to get him the ball as a receiver out of the backfield, all these different ways. You can see how physically gifted he is. He's seeing the field really well as a runner in terms of like, hey, cutbacks, navigating the trash inside the box. You saw it on the 4th-and-1. He's willing to go and stick his nose in there as a blocker. All these backs, I think, are to an extent. And so maybe even that, you know, we've seen some of the two back stuff for them in limited doses, but I think just because of the talent that you've got in that room and the various skills that each of them has, you know, sometimes you're worried when certain backs come on the field are, I know what you're going to do. You're the first down back. You're the guy who's in there to pass protect or be the scat back. And because these guys can do a bunch of different things, obviously headlined by Jeremiah, I think putting more of them on the field and presenting all those different options to a defense is a really good way to get them off balance around the line of scrimmage.
Mike, we've had a lot. It's funny with the podcast. We've had a lot of guys from your era on, including Crist and Floyd and Andrew Hendricks and so forth. And everybody loves Denbrock. And I loved the hire, and I'm sure you did too. So when people ask you, why isn't it happening yet, what do you tell them, and what do you tell them about what you think the offense might look like in November?
Because I think success is really hard to microwave, and we're in an era where, unfortunately, that's more of the norm in terms of expectations. Like, this is the second year Notre Dame's portal to quarterback. Mike Denbrock's only been with this current staff. Now, knows Marcus from Cincinnati, knows South Bend really well, but every year is a new team. And if you're coming in the offseason, remember, he didn't get to work with Riley in the spring because of injury. So all of these legitimate reasons that people on the outside don't care actually affect the football product. Surprise, surprise. So I guess I would just tell people it's a time under task thing. And I get we don't reward patience in this sport, but man, I know we talked about Brian Kelly a little bit before. Should the end of that tenure not be the perfect reminder that rewarding patience is sometimes what you need? Should the program in Michigan that should give Notre Dame hope in terms of a comp that won a national championship not show you that rewarding patience is something that we need a little bit more of? So I would just say with Coach Denbrock, he understands how to use the parts available to him very well. We saw him run. Listen, it's all similar versions of the spread offense that he ran at Cincinnati with Desmond Ridder and then to great effect with Jaden Daniels at LSU, but they weren't exactly the same because those rosters had different strengths to them. And so as the season goes along and you had, hey, we're excited about a portal group of receivers. There's still a portaled group of receivers with a portaled quarterback that everyone's getting used to. And so, yeah, the slip up early against Northern Illinois shouldn't have happened. But I do think as long as the rest of this offense stays healthy, there's reason to believe that improvement's something that's still possible.
Mike, the last game that Riley Leonard played at Duke was a 23-0 loss to Louisville, which he didn't play very well and was obviously injured. He mentioned this game as a chance for redemption for himself. He was asked about Louisville after the game on Saturday. And it's obviously the case for Notre Dame because of last year's loss as well. How real of a factor would you say revenge or redemption is in a game like this?
I mean, it's a factor in that everyone's aware of it. Like, yeah, obviously, like, Riley wants to go out there and get a win for that reason. The guys on this team all, like, I guess it's one of those things, like, you obviously you're human beings and you take that stuff personal, especially the way the loss went last year for Notre Dame at a time where they were really gaining some momentum at the beginning of the season and coming off that stretch of back-to-back-to-back night games and all the things about the schedule we knew and saw them kind of run out of gas when they got to that game. And then for Riley, you know, you're a human being. You remember that. You've got that familiarity. So it's a factor. It means that, you know, hopefully you're as dialed in as humanly possible in practice during the week. You know, that was something I said when the loss in Northern Illinois happened was, hey, we have plenty of games that we lost when I was at Notre Dame where you sort of exhaled looking at the helmet across the field or the helmet that showed up on tape. Because it isn't, you know, USC or Michigan or these teams where you're automatically ratcheted up. When you're a team that's building towards maturity, those are the things that can happen sometimes. And I think so for this team, the sign of maturity was, hey, Miami of Ohio, hey, you knew Chuck Martin. Everyone around South Bend was familiar with there. You weren't going to take them lightly after all that. Now there's no worry about the intensity or there shouldn't be because you can only look back as far as last year to see for both the quarterback and the team, hey, this is a team that got over on us in a big way. And if we don't bring our A game, they will overwhelm us.
Mike, there's some things about this game that reminds me of the Texas A&M game a little bit. And one is that Notre Dame's defense and what effect they could have on the game isn't being talked about too much. And I think they could have a big effect. So when you look at Al Golden's defense, what do you like about it right now? And what do you feel like they need to get better if they're going to help carry the offense in some games like this, or at least set the tone for games and get Notre Dame back in the playoff picture?
Yeah, I think for the defense up front, like obviously, you know, the injuries that you've sustained, you know, Jordan Botello going down to the Purdue game was devastating for the young man because he had made so many strides as a player and was such an important part of this defense. But conversely, the depth of the defense was always the thing that I lauded most about it. You were so deep at so many positions, and that one, I mean, what Bubakar's done in the stead, you go back a couple of games and he's popped for a while and we're seeing it start to show up more consistently. But that front seven, you know, Riley and Howard are going to have a huge game coming up against Louisville. I think that area against the interior of that offensive line is a place where they could really go out and be incredibly effective. The linebacker level was the one area I had some questions. Graduated a lot of snaps from last year's group, and Jack's a hell of a leader. He was the continuity in that group, but with Drake being in there, with Jalen being out there, you saw plenty of times against Northern Illinois where they were looking around, not really sure where the next, you know, the next stray was going to come from. And so I think that group continuing to play dialed in, you know, King, that's in that rotation, being able to be assignment sound against an offense in Louisville that, listen, with Jeff Brohm, you're going to get crossing routes left and right. You're going to get a bunch of misdirection stuff, especially from their under center work. And so it's going to be paramount that that linebacker crew especially has their eyes in all the right places as those guys continue to increase their workload from what they've been used to in the last couple of years. So that's probably the area that watching Notre Dame's defense most of this season has been the one where I've gone, all right, you know, we saw the benefit of the experience that's been lost there. But now with all these guys, the dynamic athleticism, all the power that they've got, as they get these reps and get more comfortable and their eyes are in the right spot, will that group continue to improve?
Mike, we've seen the Notre Dame fan base, especially the fans in Notre Dame Stadium, get a bit restless at times in games, with particularly with the play of the offense. I'm curious, like, what's your sense of how does that impact a team? I know everyone says you tune that out, but is that reality? Is that something that can play a role in impacting a team when it gets off to slow starts like it has in the first two home games of the season?
Nah, as long as they don't throw snowballs, we're cool. You do that, that's when I start to get pissed off as a player, and I still harbor a little bit of resentment over that. But the rest of it, like, you hear it, you're aware of it. Like at times, does it get a little bit annoying when you get like stuff like the boo birds coming out at home? Yeah, sure. But you're more focused on what you got to fix between series down there. You understand when you're not playing up to the standard. Believe me, as restless as the fans might be, you don't practice all week as hard as these guys do and as hard as we did to not want to go out there and execute at an incredibly high level. You understand what the stakes are when you put on that uniform. So you hear it, you're aware of it, but ultimately, it's not going to change how you're existing, especially within the body of a game, trying to go out there and execute. You're trying to do that for your teammates, the guys that you've been, you know, going at it with in the weight room since February, January, and all throughout the summer, and trying to make it happen for them. You're trying to find, you know, that's the biggest thing about game day, is it's so easy to tune that stuff out, because game day is about finding solutions. Like, you'll go and tear it down in practice. You can get dog cussed there, or you can get lifted up there. When it comes to game day, we don't have time for all that stuff. We have to figure out very quickly on the sideline how we're going to go and fix this from series to series if there are problems that need to be addressed. And so you got enough on your plate with that to not be worrying about what's going on in the stands. If you're too focused on what's going on in the stands, that means you're really not where you need to be as a football team.
Last one for me, Mike, and I want to give you a compliment first. I was watching, or was going through Twitter this morning. I saw the clip from your DraftKings show with your dad, and I love you guys together, including some pretty funny moments from, I think it was last season, where you commented on somebody's YouTube show where they had to leave the screen very quickly for...
Oh my God, what a beautiful memory.
Yeah. But switching gears on that to a different kind of effect that it might have on college football, the UNLV quarterback thing is really interesting. And I think we're kind of seeing both sides of what's going on here, both sides of what each is claiming happened there. But a guy quitting on his team over NIL in the middle of the season, whether he was promised something or whether it goes beyond that, is just mind-boggling to me. But it sounded like you guys felt like this could be the start of kind of weird things. So what's your take on that, and where do you think all this is headed?
I think my take is, no matter which side of this you believe, because like you said, there's been plenty of things put out there where clearly both sides are trying to make their own points and make it sound like theirs is the side that's, you know, on the right side of all this. The lack of clarity around the business parts of college football now are making it an environment that is hard for everybody. And a clearly defined contract would make this situation a lot easier to work through. But instead, we're talking about promises and he said situations, none of which help the team on their side trying to go out here and continue a season where they're undefeated going into a big conference game against Fresno State this weekend, or the player where they believe that they were promised something that they're not getting right now. I mean, God, from that side of things, I understand how it looks in a team sport where we're, you know, the phrasing of a guy quitting on a team right there. How many of us are showing up to a job where we're promised money that we're not getting after a little while? Like, if you're 4 weeks, if I am the head of the daily show over there at DraftKings, and we're 4 weeks into the football season, our busiest time of year, and all of a sudden the checks aren't hitting consistently after they've promised me money, there's a good chance I'm probably not going to show up either, because at some point that's how this whole operation works. There aren't a lot of coaches, I'd imagine, that would do the same thing if that was the case. But again, college football and everyone in it is paying for the lack of oversight that this sport has really never had, and just a lack of clearly defined lines and admitting what's going on here. College football is a business. These players are employees. And if you want to continue to treat it like that's not the case, you're going to wind up with a bunch of gray area like this. In the NFL, because the players are employees and you've got a collective bargaining agreement, guess what the owners were able to do? Make it really cost inefficient for players to hold out going into the season. It's why we see guys threaten it all the time, but we rarely get to that point, because you lose a lot of money. Because at the end of the day, you need a certain amount of games in order for that year to be credited. In college football, you're incentivized to stop playing. The way the redshirt rules work in this sport, you got those four games, and if you want to preserve that next year, then hey, it benefits you as the player who has a limited window to earn. And this kid at UNLV is a great example. He's not going to play pro football. He's got 4 years, you know, he's got four seasons in 5 years to make it work and maximize his earning potential and get out there and play. And so if he's got an opportunity and he doesn't believe this serves him any longer, That's what I think guys are going to do right now. The guy's been there 3 months. It's not like he's been there 4 years sweating it out with this team and he's all invested in all these guys. He came over here because apparently he thought he was promised something that he's not getting. And so until everyone involved admits what's actually going on here, I'd imagine we're going to see more instances of this.
Mike, before we let you go, I wanted to ask you about the Golic Family Foundation and the work you guys have been able to do. I know over the past weekend, I saw something that the foundation did some work with Wish Forever in terms of donating some money. And you guys have spent a lot of time and effort to raise funds for local charities in the South Bend area. What has it been like to see the impact that you guys have been able to make in the local community because of what South Bend has sort of meant to your family?
Yeah, I think it's important. We always talk about the support that we get. And I know we talked about the fan player relationship, but man, you know, living in South Bend for the better part of 5 years and now my family calling that home, you see the way the community continually wraps his arms around the school and the various sports teams on campus. You know, it's not just us, it's men's lacrosse, it's women's basketball, it's men's hockey, it's all these different sports that the community shows up and rallies for. And so to have a chance to do back and to get to see the impact for it, you know, to get to go around and you know, the Logan Center is a place that we worked at when I was on the worked with when I was on the team at Notre Dame. South Bend Home Center for the Homeless is the same way. I know Cultivate's done stuff with the current team, the Ronald McDonald House. Dad and I got a chance to go over and see the facility at the hospital downtown. And so to just know as much as we do about the community and to understand all the ways that money can go even longer when it's these organizations. It's not to say that big charities don't do a ton of great work and don't deserve their dollars as well. That's not what it is at all. But I think when you're dealing on the local level, so much of that money can go a long way. And so, yeah, the opportunity to do it with, you know, Nick and his family and what they've been doing charity wise was awesome too, to kind of keep it within the Notre Dame and the South Bend family.
All right, Mike, that's all we have for you. We really appreciate you taking time to talk to us. And if anyone hasn't yet, go check out the Gojo and Golic show on the DraftKings Network.
Thanks, guys. Appreciate it.
Before we get to our questions segment, I wanted to remind our listeners of our longstanding subscription promo for InsideIndySports.com. We're offering a 30-day free trial to our podcast listeners who want to try out a subscription to the site. That will get you access to all of our premium football analysis, our recruiting coverage, and the Insider Lounge message board, where you don't have to wait for the next podcast to ask us a question. You can take advantage of this offer by using promo code NDPOD. That's NDPOD. When you sign up for a subscription on InsideIndySports.com, you can also find a link to the deal in the podcast description or show notes. All right, now it's time for questions. You can submit questions to us on Twitter or the Insider Lounge message board before every podcast. I'm at TJamesND and Eric's at EHansonND. First one I have for us, Eric, is from Bob_Oxnard on the Insider Lounge. Assuming Leonard Moore is the third corner, who is the fourth?
Well, it's pretty easy since there's not a lot of options, and it's Carson Hobbs at this point. Now, if you had a long-term injury, let's say a couple games or more, I think the first move would be to get some reps for Rod Hurd, and I would say that over Jordan Clark. I don't think there's a great alternative at nickel for Jordan Clark, and Carson Hobbs is one of those. So I think it makes sense with the depth at safety and with Rod not being a starter that he could get in the mix there. But right now it's Carson Hobbs.
Yeah, Hobbs is the fourth. The bigger question is who the fifth is. Yeah. And we'll talk a little bit about that with this next question from at Charles W. Wolf. Are there any players on your radar who may be candidates to move to cornerback to bolster depth after Jaden Mickey's departure? I was thinking the upcoming bye week might lead to some experimentation.
Well, does Avery Davis have any eligibility? That would be my number one choice since he moved around so much, including the corner at one point. The options that we had just talked about with Hurd and Clark are two. And I tried to look at the roster and see if there was anybody that made any sense there where you weren't hurting their development for down the road, like somebody like Cam Williams or Logan Soldate, and I'm not sure that they'd even be great fits there. You know, Isaiah Dunn is a good walk-on, and I think Isaiah Dunn would be elevated some. And then of the other guys on the roster, I mean, do you really want to move Devin Ford again? But you could look at Devin Ford there and maybe Tay Johnson. Tyler, you would know better if his skills would fit corner. I mean, I know they looked at him as a nickel at one point when he comes back. I'm not sure how close he is. I think they were kind of thinking October with his injury. So hopefully Tyler has better answers than I do.
Well, I don't know that the better answers exist. We didn't put like we can't make up people who aren't on the roster. I think it seems like a not good idea to me to try Tay Johnson at corner coming off of, I mean, he's a freshman who needs some experience. He's coming off an injury, and you're going to put him at a new position. Like that just doesn't seem to be very viable. I do. The walk-ons are something that I thought of. You mentioned Isaiah Dunn. Max Herrlemann is also a cornerback who we've seen mostly on special teams. It wouldn't be ideal, but I don't. I mean, that's what we're talking about, a non-ideal situation if you're getting to people who would have been your seventh cornerback in the spring, and now they would be your fifth cornerback now when you lose Clarence Lewis and you lose Jaden Mickey and you lose Chance Tucker. To injury, that's the situation they would be in. I don't know that you would move anyone. I think, like you mentioned in the first question, Rod Heard would cross train there, while maintaining his role as the third safety and backup nickel.
Speaking of Clarence Lewis, I was watching the Stanford Syracuse game the other night, and I think Stanford had a third and long, and it was kind of this is it if they're going to get into field goal range. And Elik Iamanar caught a big pass down the field against Clarence Lewis. So.
Yeah, I saw that. And Fran Brown blamed himself rather than blaming Clarence Lewis after the game. All right, next question is from Tony Russo at T Russo ND. When someone transfers midseason, do they retain their scholarship?
Okay, so they can't enter the portal until December 9th. So what they're doing now in Jaden Mickey's case and some others is they're stating their intention to transfer. So they leave the roster. They no longer are practicing with a team. So they will stay on scholarship at Notre Dame. And oftentimes they'll stay on scholarship the next semester if they're near getting their degree. Notre Dame wants them to get their degrees. It does well for Notre Dame's graduation rates. It also does well with Notre Dame's mission. Now, if they've been asked to transfer, that's a different story. Like Max Redfield's situation comes to mind where they didn't want him, they were kind of booting him out of school. And so he didn't have a scholarship. He had to go somewhere else. And there's been some others. But in general, they do let those guys stay on scholarship.
Yeah, and there's like no advantage for Notre Dame to move things around. Like you're not like your 85 scholarship number was already set at the beginning of the season, so there's no like it doesn't there's nothing that Notre Dame would be able to benefit from not seeing things out with the scholarship for the rest of the semester or the rest of the school year for those players. All right, next question is from SJB75 on the Insider Lounge. 4 games in, what has surprised you the most about this football team that you did not expect 4 to 5 weeks ago?
Duh, the Northern Illinois game. No, but I mean, beyond that, some things that let's go with the icky surprises first. How vehemently some fans can't stand Riley Leonard. Probably the surprise to me on the defensive line is Cross and Mills not playing at a higher level through 4 games. I don't think they've tanked it, but I thought they'd be a little bit more dominant. Jaden Mickey's transfer was a surprise. How the Florida State game lost its shine is a surprise. Slow development at the field receiver, James Rendell's long on-ramp to find himself. And then good surprises. I think Bo Collins being the number one receiver, he was intriguing to me, and I thought there was a possibility he could be better than we thought, and he's kind of way better. Kennedy Urlacher's flash in the Purdue game. Aeneas Williams has impressed me. Jaden Harrison in the passing game. Not a lot beyond that has surprised me from a good standpoint. I expected this team to be a playoff team, so I expected a lot of good.
Yeah, I only came up with one thing, but to me, it's just that the passing game hasn't been better. That's the biggest surprise about this season for me. I didn't think it would be as bad as it has been. I still believe it can improve, but it's far, it's fallen far below the expectations that I had for the season. All right, next question is from Scuba VT on the Insider Lounge. Do you think Riley Leonard was worth the $1.1 million NIL cost?
You know, Scuba is one of my favorite people in message board land. But I'd hate to put any player's worth in NIL terms, and not just because a lot of those numbers are inflated, floated by agents, their guesses. How I'll phrase it was getting Riley Leonard out of the portal worth it. I do think it makes more sense to evaluate this at the end of the season. But if I'm answering this question now, whether it works out or not, I think it was a move I applauded at the time, and I would take that risk again.
Yeah, whatever NIL Riley Leonard is being paid, folks that don't like Riley Leonard want to use that against him. What I would suggest to people is that, hey, if Riley Leonard wasn't getting paid that money, someone else would be getting paid that money. Steve Angeli was going to be the starting quarterback. He was going to get paid money too. So it's just like, don't worry about the money that you're not paying someone. Like, I don't know why people get so like caught up in arms about that. But I certainly don't think that the Notre Dame boosters that are paying the NLI or NIL to Riley Leonard are getting the return on investment they had hoped for. I think that money was going to be spent regardless if Riley Leonard was brought in from Duke or if Steve Angeli was stuck behind and made the starter going into the season.
I mean, some people are really tied into that money thing. And early in my marriage, we used to go down and visit my aunt or my wife's aunt and uncle in Florida. And he was a big Cubs fan, and he'd cut out the paper, the salary of the Cubs players. And when they would make an error, he would pull that clipping out and decide how mad he was going to get at the player based on how much they were making. So,
all right. If that's the case, then maybe they shouldn't get too mad at us because we don't make that much
right.
Money.
You can pull out the paper and say, "What? Where are all the zeros?" Unfortunately, the zeros at the beginning.
At student driver asks, what would it take for Freeman to utilize Angeli more?
It would take an injury to Riley Leonard or a severely backward step developmentally for him to use Steve Angeli more, or more 66-7 games.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think there's a plan that exists that would be like using the two of them in concert with each other. Like what it would take is a belief that Angeli should be the starting quarterback and then he would be the starting quarterback and they'd use him more. That belief doesn't exist. And so we'll continue to see Riley Leonard until that changes. All right. Next question is, we pulled some questions from Eric's chat this week to add to our question total. So this one is from Pat from Bordenton, New Jersey. Watching Riley Leonard, are you getting any Ron Polis vibes? After Polis's second collarbone break in 94, he was never the same and had happy feet. Do you get that vibe from Leonard, that it's a mental block after all of the surgeries and then the Northern Illinois injury in quotation marks / sack?
I don't think that at all. I know that I've talked to Dane Crist about his injuries, for example, and in retrospect, he admitted being physically compromised and he wasn't able to be the same quarterback. I don't think that's the case with Dane Crist, and I don't think he's got happy feet. I think these are the same challenges he would have had whether he had the ankle injury or not. I don't think it was a result of, oh my gosh, the protection broke down. Like when he was at Duke, he didn't get sacked very much, and he hasn't got sacked very much at Notre Dame, given the youth of the offensive line. I do think there is a part of him that has to trust the people around him in terms of moving up in the pocket, in terms of throwing the ball down the field and extending plays instead of running. But I think had he stayed at Duke, had he transferred somewhere else, and he was trying to be a more truly dual threat quarterback, this is a stage that he would have gone through.
Yeah, I think certainly the physical setbacks aren't helping, because like in the grander picture, I think it's all about being Riley Leonard being comfortable. And so I do think that missing time in the spring, that delayed the process, and Notre Dame is not getting as far along with Riley Leonard, and Riley Leonard isn't getting as far along as he'd want to because of that. So I mean, I guess what I would say is, like, those aren't excuses, like, to, or valid reasons for progress to not continue, right? Like, he has to continue to get better, and we can't keep pointing to those things when you have games in a season to allow those things to grow. If they're not growing during the season and getting better game by game, although it doesn't have to be exactly linear, then I think that's when you could think about, well, is this actually working out? Why is it not working out? I don't think he's standing in the pocket scared. I think he is trying to get the most out of a play that he feels like he can do confidently. And sometimes that triggers in his head to, like, hey, I can do things with my legs. I've done it plenty of times before. So then I'm going to try to do that. If you read my film analysis this week, he didn't have the issues against Miami of Ohio that he did in previous games where he would sort of run himself into pressure. He stayed in the pocket. He did scramble at times, but it was when that pressure actually existed. There wasn't phantom pressure that was forcing him out of the pocket. So I do see some progress there, and the hope for Notre Dame is that continues.
Okay, Tyler, let me ask you this as a follow, since you do the film reviews and stuff. In the raw numbers, Leonard's best two games, and I'm not saying he's at the level he needs to be, and certainly not even for Louisville, and we'll see if he makes another jump, but don't you think the last two games were his two best games? Don't you think he's a better quarterback in the last two games than he was against Northern Illinois, or even against, in some ways, Texas A&M?
Yeah, I mean, I think you could probably – I don't know that the Miami game was that much better than his Texas A&M game. Like, the Texas A&M game wasn't great, but it wasn't terrible either. I think the Northern Illinois one is the true outlier. The Miami of Ohio game, there were some bad spots where he just had bad throws, and he had the same issue in the Texas A&M game. It did seem to me like the Miami of Ohio game felt like – this is the direction it's supposed to be heading, and, like, things are starting to culminate in a positive direction now. We can only guess what's going to happen from here. But I think that's fair. Like, I think the Texas A&M performance gets lumped in with the Northern Illinois performance too much because of the wall that Northern Illinois game represented. But I don't think it was as bad as some of us are remembering. All right. Next question is from Skip from Houston. Notre Dame has two of the best coordinators in college football and a charismatic head coach, yet the team at times plays mediocre football. Captains are chosen for the leadership skills. I wonder what your thoughts are about whether our five captains as a group are consistently meeting their responsibilities. Perhaps this is a problem area.
Yeah, well, I would start, and Skip has emailed me from time to time, and he's a really good guy, but we're going to disagree on the phrasing of his question here a little bit. Not sure beating a top 25 team on the road and handing a team their worst loss in 100 plus years of football is mediocre. Let's go with mediocre moments and enough of them strung together on September 7th to create a loss. But in terms of the captains, I haven't seen anything in their play or in talking to players that would point to that as a problem. And when I was trying to figure out who might be the captains, I mean, these were some of the guys that came to mind as players that I thought, you know, other players talked about and how much their leadership was important to them. So I haven't seen that. Maybe Tyler has a different take on it, but I don't see that as a problem.
Yeah, I don't either. I have no qualms with Notre Dame's captains. I don't think player leadership prevented the offense from playing well against NIU or starting slow against Miami. I don't think player leadership caused Notre Dame's defense to not get off the field against NIU. Those are performance based and not leadership based, in my opinion. So I don't think that's the case. I think I would put the blame more on the coaching staff, and the players not executing than the captains not leading in the right way. Next question is from LDL Go Irish on the Insider Lounge. I watched the Louisville versus Georgia Tech game last night and thought the quarterback runs were open for Georgia Tech. Georgia Tech balanced that with some nice timely passing, mostly short, but also down the field. Is Riley Leonard ready to duplicate this performance by Haynes King, the Georgia Tech quarterback? How much, in your opinion, should QB run options be part of the Notre Dame game plan? QB runs and timely passing could also open up lanes for Jeremiah Love and Jadarian Price. Louisville seems stout against the straight-up running plays.
You know what, LDL Go Irish asked some long questions, but I'd take him on my reporting team anytime. I like the way he looks at games and processes them. I do think Louisville will also learn from that tape. They'll try to fix some of their fits. This is really the first game that they've had to deal with an offense of any kind, and Haynes King is a handful, and he presents a lot of the same skill set that Riley Leonard does. I think this also is encouraging for Notre Dame with regard to Riley Leonard's skill set being part of the solution for Louisville's rush defense. I think the flow of the game's going to dictate how many carries, but I'll give you two instances of where it came into play when Mike Denbrock was a play caller here last time, and that they were both in 2015 that came to my mind, and that was the Clemson game down in the monsoon and the Temple game in Philadelphia when Tyler and I cried at how good our Philly steak sandwiches were. But in those two games, DeShone Kizer ran 14 times and 17 times. He had a lot of yards in both of those games. The other element that's going to be really interesting is Jeremiah Love is going to get a lot of play as a wide receiver. I think this is the game. CJ Procise in those two games did the same thing, and he had four receptions for 100 yards against Clemson. He had five receptions in the Temple game. And I could see if Notre Dame feels like there's a mismatch when Louisville loads the box with putting Love on the outside and getting some passes downfield, I think that's something to look for.
Is Riley Leonard
So
ready?
I matched him with wordiness.
No. You did a good job and good research. I appreciate LDL, even though sometimes it results in me talking long in terms of reading the question, but LDL shows their work, and I appreciate that. Is Riley Leonard ready was one of the questions. He better be, right? Like that Notre Dame needs him to be. I do think that the zone read will remain a staple of ND's offense with some quarterback runs that are designed as keepers, not just decisions that he's making. As I've been saying, that there are benefits to the rest of the offense and Riley Leonard's ability to do that, even if folks who want to stare at his passing numbers aren't willing to give him credit for that. So I think there's a game plan that Notre Dame can win this game without Riley Leonard lighting it up in the passing game. I think that is possible. It certainly could be more difficult in doing that, and it stresses your ability to make the right decisions in those quarterback op run options, and stresses the decisions in the running lanes that those guys are taking. But I do agree with you about the love at receiver. I mean, Notre Dame's done a few different things. There was a third down that Mitchell Evans was technically the running back next to Riley Leonard with the, I don't remember if it was Price or Love in the game split out at receiver, but Notre Dame is doing different things to try to spread out the defense. And we see a lot of empty looks, and because you still have a running threat back there with Riley Leonard. So Notre Dame's trying to do things to spread out a defense, even if the passing game isn't always the thing that is stretching that defense. All right, next question is from at Alan Sturgill. One, how good is the Louisville running game? And two, how good is the Louisville passing defense?
You know, I think Louisville has the smallest sample size that you can get that's really usable, and that's the Georgia Tech game. I don't think the Jacksonville State
Right.
and Austin Peay games help us out much because the numbers are really inflated, and they didn't stand up in the Georgia Tech game. in either of those areas that Allen's asking about. They only rushed for 57 yards. It looks like they're using Chaney more at the beginning of the season. I'm guessing that he was hurt. It's Chaney and two guys named Brown, and none of them ran for very much against Georgia Tech's defense. They had 57 yards in rushing, and they were 2 of 9 on third down conversions against Georgia Tech. Georgia Tech outgained them. And then in the passing game, Haynes King found some, soft spots in the defense. It wasn't, air it out and trash him down the field. But I mean, he threw for 320 yards. And I do think that's the most susceptible part of their defense. Now, again, they've been banged up there. They may be a little bit healthier there this week. We'll see. But I think those are the two areas that Notre Dame has a chance to really take advantage of. And Al Golden sometimes, again, doesn't play with a heavy box, doesn't play with a loaded box. This may be one of those games where he may want to do that a little bit more often. Because I think you can make Louisville one-dimensional and rely on the sixth best pass defense in the United States.
Yeah, Louisville's running game isn't great, and they're going to be without Maurice Turner, who's the starting running back for the second consecutive game. So there's been a little bit of a roulette with the running back situation, and I think that's obviously one injury based, but also I think a sign of not knowing who's necessarily the best or feeling that someone is extremely reliable in that running game. The long runs is something that they've done well. And that's come those came against their weaker opponents. So Louisville ranks fourth nationally with 7 runs of at least 20 yards and 4 runs of at least 30 yards, which has inflated the yards per carry. So they're up to 6.4 yards per carry, which is ninth in the FBS. But Georgia Tech limited them to 2.1 yards per carry. So I think the reality of Louisville's running game is closer to the what Georgia Tech did against them than the other guys, like Eric mentioned. I think the pass defense is sort of decent, but hasn't been tested outside of Georgia Tech, like we've been saying. And Georgia Tech was able to get 312 passing yards, so I think that this. I don't think the passing defense is something that should necessarily scare Notre Dame. The pass rush is something to be concerned about, but I think so much of like where Notre Dame is in terms of its offense is like self-imposed or self-inflicted, than it is, in my opinion, based on like what Louisville presents as a challenge. All right, next question is from Mike D from Rochester, New York. If Rocco Spindler continues to show improvement at the guard position and outperforms Sam Pendleton, does Billy Shrouth bump Sam when he returns? If so, does Shrouth move to left guard?
So I think Billy Shrouth, when he's healthy, he will go right back to his right guard position. Now, let's say Rocco plays lights out until Billy Shrouth comes back. And especially if this happens, if he's getting close during the bye week, I think you look at whether Rocco or Pendleton makes more sense there. I thought it was interesting, Mike Golic Jr.'s evaluation of Sam Pendleton. He seems to be pretty encouraged by him. But if Rocco again shows it in games, especially, and this is a big game for Rocco in terms of how he would perform against a really good defensive front. So I don't anticipate that would happen, but I'm not shutting the door on that either.
Yeah, I agree that it would be Rocco moving to left guard if that were the case. They're not going to move Shrouth to left guard. I'm not sold either way that Rocco would or wouldn't be a better replacement for Sam Pendleton. Sam Pendleton has had good moments as well. The biggest difference, and Pendleton has played more this season, is that the bad moments for Pendleton have been bad, where Rocco hasn't had those bad moments yet. So I think that will be something that Joe Rudolph will have to take into account when making that decision. All right, next from Kevin from Sleepy Eye, Minnesota. First quarter last Saturday was hard to watch. My question is winning enough? Do we need additional style points against the remaining opponents to get in the playoffs, or is 11-1 enough?
So, Kevin, I think that's interesting. And Sleepy Eye is a real town of Minnesota. Kevin is a regular in the chat. And he usually has exclamation points, which I love.
He probably had him, but I got rid of him
Well, Manny, the
for
exclamation, Manny from San Pedro was the original exclamation point, and then other people are jumping on board because I react to Manny's. But
Yeah, I tried to pare down on all the exclamation points. There were some smiley faces and all the
and the compliments.
Eric compliments. I got rid of all those. This isn't Eric's chat, so I don't have to let him fly.
But Kevin, for me, it's your question is to get into the playoffs. And my question back is the goal getting into the playoffs or is it getting in and winning in the playoffs? And so I don't think they need style points to get into the playoff. I think 11-1, given the schedule, especially if USC has a reasonably good record at the end of the year, and especially because some of these other teams like Stanford and Georgia Tech and Navy and Army and Virginia all have a little bit better records than anticipated. But in terms of seeding, you want to show that you're an improved team. You want to show in November that this in no way is the team that lost to Northern Illinois. And then in terms of being prepared to win a game in the playoff, this team needs to be better than it is now, or they're going to have the kind of playoff performance that they've had the last two times they were in the 4-team version. So I do think improving is something that needs to be part of the equation, not just winning.
Right, yeah. On paper, 11-1 is enough to get in. I don't think it's hard for me to imagine Notre Dame winning the rest of its game and not getting in. But Notre Dame needs to look good in doing it to guarantee a home game. That would be the distinction that I would make. All right, Marie Biafore at Biafore Marie asks, as Mike Dembrock has said, the offense is a work in progress. What do you think the ceiling is for this offense, particularly the passing game? With new injuries and the NIU loss, what are your expectations for the season and what would you consider a successful season?
So, the ceiling for the offense, I mean, is tied to several things, and they're all, I think, moving in the right direction, not at warp speed, but Riley Leonard's improvement, the wide receiver's improvement, and Jordan Faison being healthy, I think, helps that. The offensive line's improvement, the way that Pat Coogan and Rocco have stepped in certainly helps with that. So I think this could be a pretty good offense by the end of the season. I went back and looked at Jaden Daniels' first year at LSU, and he was kind of in this Riley Leonard pattern for the first 4 or 5 games there. And then he had a big stretch against, I think it was Florida LSU or Florida Ole Miss and Alabama. They won all three of those games, put up a bunch of points in those games. I'm not predicting 45 points against teams of that caliber, but I think this offense has room to grow, and I anticipate them growing into that. What does that look as far as a ceiling? I'm not sure how to describe it, but I think you'll see, I think you need to see this weekend them defeating a defense that had them shackled last year. They're going to, I think this is the reason you go out and get Mike Denbrock. This is the reason you get Riley Leonard out of the portal when you have a young offensive line. This is kind of what you think you're going to start to see the possibility of what this offense can be this weekend, for better or for worse. I'll let you answer that part of the question, then we'll go with what are your expectations in a successful season, since I did a monologue there.
Sure. I don't know that the ceiling has changed much. Like I just think that the likelihood of Notre Dame reaching that ceiling has decreased a little bit. I think this offense can still be one that's dynamic, that can win games on the ground and in the air. But everyone has to play well to do that. I think they have a coordinator that is willing to and able to design plays to allow that to happen. And it has been slow going so far, but I don't think that the loss or even the injuries that we've seen so far have really changed what the possibilities for this offense can be. I think it's going to be harder to get there, but I think it's still possible. I don't think it's impossible to sort of get that ceiling. And I don't know how to describe it either. I don't know, like, if you want to points per game average or like yards per game. I don't know what those, I don't have those numbers, but I do think that the ceiling is still pretty high.
And then with new injuries and the NIU loss, what are your expectations for the season and what would you consider a successful season? My bar for a successful season hasn't changed, and that's playoff or bust. I think this team needs to get into the playoff. I think if we're talking about Pop-Tarts Bowl, other than them being a tasty, unhealthy breakfast, I think that that's going to be a disappointment.
Yeah, I think in terms of expectations, if I'm being honest, I would expect Notre Dame to lose another game this season now. I don't know that I didn't expect them to necessarily lose two going into the season, but I'm not wholly confident that Notre Dame can run the table right now. I'm not saying it won't happen or it can't happen, but if you made me predict, I would guess that Notre Dame's going to lose another game. So that would be my expectation for the rest of the season. In terms of what would I consider a successful season, I think making the playoffs is a successful season, not making it is an unsuccessful season. I think it's pretty cut and dry there for me. All right, next question is Matt from Austin. Two quick ones. Is Deuce Knight just enjoying the attention and love? And if so, why does he seemingly still recruit for Notre Dame? I sense that a very strong quarterback room may be at the heart of his indecision. Number two, at this point in the season, which coordinator, Denbrock or Golden, do you feel has done the better job? Offense has certainly improved, and defense has played seven really good halves.
Okay, I'll start with the coordinator question. I think Golden has done the better job. I think Denbrock had the harder job, and he knew that walking in the door. My take on Deuce Knight not being in the weeds like Tyler is with this, I don't think he's enjoying the attention and the love so much. I mean, I don't think that that's why he's doing this. I think legitimately, maybe staying close to home. He's made a lot of trips up to Notre Dame. Maybe he thought, wow, it's way easier to drive over to Auburn than it is to fly to South Bend so much. But I think there's people in his ear. I don't know that these kids make these decisions in a vacuum, and sometimes family enters into it, and then you get a little bit confused, and they may have a lot of sway in your decisions. And there's some families that just kind of leave the kid alone and let him make his decisions. So that's my from the outside looking in and not talking to the family perspective. Tyler will have a better one.
Yeah, first to the part about does he seemingly still recruit for Notre Dame, or why does he seemingly do that? I don't think that Deuce Knight has been actively recruiting for Notre Dame in the same way he once did. He certainly is still friends and close with Notre Dame's commits, and that's hasn't changed. But I don't know that he's doing the same sort of outreach to guys that Notre Dame's going after that he did prior to this latest round of flirtations with Auburn and Ole Miss to some extent. My perspective is it seems to me like he's wanted to commit to Auburn, but he's not seeing enough to get him to do it. The way that Auburn has played has created some hesitation for him, and that's why he keeps visiting there. It's almost like he's waiting for something to finally convince him to make this decision, and it's just not happening. As it relates to Notre Dame, like Deuce Knight has always been aware of CJ Carr, so I don't think it's necessarily like a realization of what Notre Dame has, but more of a realization of what Auburn doesn't have. It could be an easier place to get on the field, but the question then becomes, will that lead to success for him? Is he getting put into a winning position if he goes to Auburn? And I had the same answer as you on the coordinator front. Al Golden has done a better job, and Mike Denbrock has had a harder job. All right, next is Chaunce in Toledo. I assume SEC stadiums allow beer slash alcohol sold in their stadiums. Any sense as to whether Notre Dame will ever allow this? It has to lead to a more raucous crowd.
Yeah, and Chaunce in the chat had Had a initial question about why the atmosphere was so dead, and I kind of threw some of my opinions out. So this was his follow-up. Maybe alcohol will juice it up. They do sell alcohol in parts of the stadium. You have to have be in the luxury suites to be able to do that. And would they do it for the whole stadium? I think they're going to be really reluctant and slow to move in that direction. I'm not ruling it out, but way back they had a night game years ago before they started this iteration of night games that have been really successful. And it was a disaster. People were partying all day long, and there was a lot of damage around the stadium and in the neighborhoods. And so they thought, never again are we ever going to go to night game. And then suddenly night games seem no different than day games, except a lot more fun. So maybe they'll eventually get to that point. The fact that they are selling it in parts of the stadium, I think, leads you to believe that at least they would consider it.
Yeah, I don't think it's like imminent or extremely likely, but I certainly wouldn't be surprised by it either. Like, I don't know, like I'm not the best Catholic in the world, but I was born and raised Catholic, and I don't think drinking has ever been an issue for Catholics.
Right.
So I don't know, that would be like a line that you couldn't cross at Notre Dame. So the fact that you can drink in certain areas of the stadium is certainly not unfathomable that you would do that. It just seems like one of those things that Notre Dame is not going to be a leader in, and it's going to sort of maybe be one of the last ones to do, if that's the case. But I don't know either way. I'm not sure. I mean, it's a way to make money, and so many things of that come into the sporting world now are about making money. So at some point, I wouldn't be surprised if Notre Dame goes ahead and does that. All right, our last one is at Joe Hughes 7012. Thoughts on the Matthew Sliuca situation?
Yikes. I think the one thing that I can take away from it without extrapolating too much down the road, and I think Mike Golic Jr. had a great, I mean, he said, so I go back and listen to that part of the podcast. But one thing that was really apparent to me was what if these things continue to happen, how conflicting the stories are. You're getting stories from agents now and stories from the school, and they don't line up. And the introduction of agents putting their two cents worth in, I think we've seen it in other areas, like maybe an agent leaking an injury of a player or leaking some other kind of information out there. And I think, college sports isn't what it used to be, and we're going to have to get used to this business aspect of it.
Yeah, I mean, we could do a whole podcast series on this. So trying
Right.
to fit all my thoughts into a few minutes here would be tough, but a few different things that I wanted to mention. Like, one, this just reemphasizes that NIL numbers are often fake. Even the people that are involved with getting the money and supposedly providing the money can't even agree on what is agreed to or not agreed to. So when you see all the numbers that are out there, I do not believe them. Like, take them for a grain of salt. There is money being moved around, but the whether or not it's actually being moved around and what's being promised and what's being provided are often can be very different things. In this situation, everyone's pointing the finger at someone else. It exposes the chaos of the system, or the lack of a system that's in place. The coaches aren't writing the checks that they're promising. NIL collectives are the ones writing the checks. And UNLV isn't going to admit to an NCAA violation. So I don't know who is right or wrong in this situation in terms of what's being alleged. It certainly doesn't help that Marcus Cromartie, that who's an agent for Equity Sports that's representing Sliuca, isn't licensed in Nevada. That would seem like, well, if you're going to represent someone that plays for a program in Nevada, that should be on your list of things to do. It seems to be clear to me that the player is trying to create leverage. I don't know that he's going to get what he wants, either at UNLV or somewhere else next season. But he could be a symbol that could help create change in the system to allow us to get more streamlined and have more rules in place that prevent things like this. Now, I think stuff like this is still going to happen. And players, regardless of NIL situations, are going to make decisions of what they feel like they can benefit from. There's so much power that is being given to the players now with the ability to sit out the rest of the season to maintain your eligibility, entering the transfer portal, all those things. So I think some of that stuff isn't going to go away, but I think there should be a better way for some of this NIL stuff to be handled and for it to be a more for it to actually be what it's being used to be. Like, a lot of this is pay for play, but it's everyone's finding a way around it being actual pay for play. So that's why UNLV is getting, hey, we don't do those kinds of things. Of course you don't, but I'm sure there's plenty of players on that team that are getting paid. And the UNLV coaching staff is well aware of it and had some say in who was getting the money that's being provided. So to me, it's just, to me, I think it's a bigger indictment on the system than it is for the player. I think certainly people have their opinions on if a player should be quitting the team like this and doing something that could hurt the team that you're on. But I mean, he's kind of a paid assassin in that, like, he's a transfer there for 1 year anyway, so like he doesn't have that much loyalty to that program. So that's sort of a consequence of having a system that allows for that. All right, well, that is it for today's episode of the Inside Indie Sports Podcast. If you don't already, you can subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and other popular podcast platforms. If you like what you hear, give us a star rating, leave a review, and share a podcast feed with someone who's paying NIL to players. As I mentioned earlier, we're offering a 30-day free trial of InsideNDSports.com to our podcast listeners who want to try out a subscription to the site. Just use promo code NDPOD when you sign up for a subscription. You can also find a link to the deal in the podcast description or show notes. Over on YouTube, we'll have Place Your Bets with our Louisville predictions coming Friday, and then our post-game takeaways late after the game. And as always, we have plenty of written content to get you ready for the weekend, so stick with InsideNDSports.com for all your Notre Dame football coverage needs.